Good morning and welcome to Jewish Faith and Jewish Facts. I'm Rabbi Stephen Garten speaking to you from Ottawa, Canada. As longtime listeners of our show may remember, each and every week, I invite guests to unpack the weekly Torah portion known in Hebrew as the Parashah. This week, however, we're going to do something a little bit different, and we are going to unpack the unusual confluence between the Jewish holiday of Passover, which the Jewish people are in the midst of observing, and the holiday of Easter, which usually comes simultaneously with Passover, but this year came almost a month prior to the first night of Passover. With me to discuss the whys of Passover and Easter, a Rabbi Brooks Sussman, the founding rabbi of Congregation Kol Am in Freehold, and an adjunct professor at Brookdale Community College. Rabbi Sussman has served congregations in St. Louis, Missouri, New York, New Jersey, and is often paired with his colleague, Chris Bellito, in what is known as the God Squad. Chris Bellito is a professor of history at Kane University in Union, New Jersey, where he teaches courses in ancient and medieval history. He is a specialist in medieval and church history, and his latest book entitled Humility, The Secret History of a Lost Virtue, published by Georgetown University Press this past year. He has twice won grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. He has been visiting scholar at Princeton Theological Seminary and a Fulbright specialist in New Zealand and Netherlands. Well, gentlemen, welcome to Jewish Faith and Jewish Facts.
Thanks for having us.
It's a really pleasure to have it. This is a first for us virtually.
Well, I know that the two of you are often on the road as the God Squad, speaking to audiences about similarities and differences between Judaism and Christianity. And now you have an opportunity to speak on the radio and perhaps for people to listen to you via the podcast. So we're speaking about Passover and Easter. And as I introduced you, I noted that they usually come simultaneously or very close to each other, but this year is different. So, Chris, let's begin with you. What is the usual means of scheduling Easter?
So this is frightening for me because it involves math, and I am not very good at math. So let's begin by saying I'm going to speak about Western Latin Christianity, not Eastern Greek Christianity, which I'll mention in a minute. So in the West, you calculate Easter in the following way. It is the first Sunday after the first full moon after March 21st. So March 21st is what's known as the spring or the vernal equinox. So the first Sunday after the first full moon after March 21st. So what that means practically is that Easter in the West can be as early as March 22nd and as late as April 25th. This year, it was March 31st. In the East, they follow a different calendar, the Julian calendar, and that is the calendar that was set by Julius Caesar around 45-47 BCE, and that calendar was pretty good, but it was slightly off. And over the course of many centuries, in fact, 16 centuries, it was 11 days off. So in the year 1582, a pope by the name of Gregory declared that everyone would go to bed on October 4th and wake up the next morning on October 15th. And so that is why there is a discrepancy between the Latin West and the Greek East. The Latin West Easter, as I said, was March 31st. Because it follows the Gregorian calendar. The Greek East calendar, following the Julian calendar, this year will be April 5th. And sometimes it just falls that the West and East are the same day. The last time that happened was 2017. The next time that will happen is 2025. And through a strange quirk, it will be about every 3 years until 2048 that the Latin West Easter will be the same as the Greek East Easter.
Now, there are many other Christian denominations in the world besides Roman Catholicism and Eastern Catholicism, Greek Catholicism. Of course, there's the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, as well as other churches that are a result of the Byzantine Empire. Do they all follow one or the other pattern of dating?
Yes, they all fall in those two big categories. So generally, all of the Protestant churches that we group together as Protestant, there are many, Methodist, Lutheran, Seventh-day Adventists, etc., they would all be following the Latin West calendar. And the minority would be what we would have under the huge rubric Greek East, and right. That would be the various churches that you've mentioned and many others in smaller numbers.
Good.
In fact, if I may, the current Pope and the current Patriarch, Patriarch of Constantinople and Pope Francis, have both been having conversations working toward unity or at least agreeing to celebrate Easter on the same day. And it might be that that is something that could occur over continued negotiations, possibly some people are saying within 5 or 10 years.
So there's nothing theological in the dating of Easter. Good. Let's now turn to the dating of Passover.
No.
And I'm going to ask Rabbi Sussman, who is equally uninformed about mathematics, to help us understand the nuances of the Hebrew calendar.
Well, the Jewish festivals are never on time. As a kid, I always thought the High Holy Days fell during Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, but now they've changed everything. And so we're never at the true time. The problem with the Jewish calendar is that it's the Hebrew calendar based on the solar calendar, which is the 12-month, 365-and-one-half days, which is the Gregorian. But the Hebrew calendar is the lunar calendar. And so with few exceptions, biblical holidays are going to fall on the full moon, with the exception of Rosh Hashanah, the New Year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. But the pilgrim festivals, the three pilgrimage festivals where you would bring the first fruits of your field to the temple for sacrifice, are agricultural times. To correspond for the Hebrew calendar and the Gregorian calendar, there's what's called intercalation, so that we have leap months rather than a leap year. And so seven times in a 19-year cycle, the Jews add an extra month, the month of Adar. So there's Adar 1 and Adar 2. That way, the Gregorian calendar and the Hebrew calendar eventually can have the same starting point and not go so completely skewed that festivals are no longer meaningful.
So for our listeners who may be aware of Ramadan, the festival of intense spirituality in Islam, Islam uses a totally lunar calendar. And you may be aware that Ramadan can occur in a variety of different months. This past year, it just concluded in the month of March and April, but it can also be in August. And it has no impact or importance to the Muslim community when it occurs. But Easter always has to occur in the spring, and Passover also has to occur in the spring.
Yes.
Well, Easter, of course, is a celebration of new life. Christians believe that Jesus passes from death to life. And so that was one of the problems with that 11-day mix-up over time, was that Easter was falling back into winter, which doesn't make any sense, if you will, theologically. One of the interesting things as we move into the modern era in the 16th and 17th centuries, We get better at using astronomy, although our forebears were actually better than we were, using instruments that were quite complex. Just because they're older doesn't mean that they weren't better. But there are still some nuances that will take place. So, for instance, Muslims look to see the crescent moon and or three stars in the sky. And so the question becomes, what if it is cloudy where you are, but not cloudy somewhere else? And another question that some Jewish families have, which I learned from Brooks, is that some people have two Passover dinners.
The first and second days of a holiday, the moon. And everything is based on the sighting of the new moon in Jerusalem, as a matter of fact. Then the two kosher witnesses would see it. They'd go to the temple. The high priest would look up. Oh, yes, I see the new moon. And they'd give him a meal. And so, but once we moved into the diaspora, we determined we don't know exactly when that first crescent moon will be seen in Jerusalem. So it was 2 days outside of Israel. In Israel, holidays are only 1 day. Yes. Oh, absolutely so. And in fact, my branch of Reform Judaism, we traditionally observe 1 day of the holiday following the Jerusalem ritual rather than the diasporic.
So that's true today.
Now, it's important for our Christian listeners to know that the Jewish day goes sunset to sunset. And so there has been some attempts, and if you're interested in this, the best book on this is Raymond Brown's The Death of the Messiah, to actually calculate when the first Good Friday was. And the two calculations are based on Jewish dating. I have to consistently remind Christians that Jesus was a nice Jewish boy. And the critical date of this is the 14th day of the month of Nisan. And so theologically, Jesus has to die on Passover because it is the great, from the Christian theological perspective, the great redemption, the great passing from bondage. And now, of course, we're going back to Moses and the Ten Commandments, from bondage into freedom. And if you do the calculations, kind of like now we could go on Google and say, you know, what day of the week did Columbus, you know, first land in the Caribbean? If you do those calculations, there are two dates that present themselves. They happen to be April 7th in the year 30, which is the 14th day of the month of Nisan, or April 3rd in the year 33. And of those two, if you put together other calculations as to the traditional date of Jesus's birth, Jesus was likely born in the year 6 or 5 or 4 BCE because of a miscalculation. Then Passover, April 7th in the year 30, is the 14th day of the month of Nisan. So now the question becomes whether Holy Thursday, what in some traditions is called Maundy Thursday, Holy Thursday, what is sometimes referred to as the institution of the priesthood or the institution of the Eucharist, when Jesus says, take this bread and eat it, which of course was matzah, take this blood and drink it, this is my body and this is my blood. The question becomes if that was in fact a Passover meal, depending on whether you're counting from sunset to sunset of the next day.
So, Chris, you've indicated nicely how the narrative of Easter can be somewhat complementary to the narrative of Passover by using the words of from slavery to freedom, as if being of this world was of the slave world and being of freedom is Jesus's death. But for our listeners who may be less aware of what you're speaking of, Brooks, help us understand how the Jewish tradition uses those words slavery and freedom, and then how redemption plays a part in the Passover epic, which certainly has carryover into the Easter narrative.
Jews sojourned into Egypt, and they became a mighty nation. And then a new king, a new pharaoh arose. Not only a new pharaoh, but his name, if his name is going to be Ramses, it's going to be Ra, the sun god. And so he is chosen as the sun god. And these Hebrews who were there were following another tradition, following the tradition of his predecessor, who gave them freedom during the Hyksos dynasty. And so it's a tug of war in terms of deities and strength and taking over a new regime. And so that because he feared that the Hebrews would become a fifth column, he enslaved them. And that enslavement lasted for 420 years. We should not ask the question, the unanswerable question, so God, where was you? How come you waited so long? Because now we're dealing with the movement from polytheism through what's known as monolatry to monotheism. This redemption is going to be at the hand of God, who is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in Hebrew, Y-H-W-H, or pronounced Jehovah. It's all one and the same. And this God is going to best the God of Egypt. The quintessential moment becomes in the 10 plagues, because the Hebrew become, the nuance becomes important. Moses says, let my people go. Pharaoh changes his mind in the first five of the plagues. Once we get to the sixth through the 10th plague, Pharaoh's mind was changed. And so essentially the first five, Pharaoh still had control. Ra had control. From the sixth through the 10th, it became the God of Israel, one of the Elohim, which is the word for God, and it's plural, moves from an Elohim, one of the Elohim, to Ha Elohim, the God, which is why when we deal with this, we're going to refer to him as the Lord God. They become one and the same. This God is going to free the children of Israel from their slavery. And interestingly, the term for Egypt is Mitzrayim. It's a narrow place if you look from above. The term for pressed down is Mitzarim. Or Mitzarim, the idea is that we are moving from a puffed up, ego-filled individual personality to becoming egoless and recognizing what freedom really is. The children of Israel had to be enslaved so that they could find their freedom. On the way, they come through the Sea of Reeds, the Yam Suf, the Red Sea, and we're told that Pharaoh following them and the waters crashed then in upon them, which I believe is truly the 11th plague, the death of Pharaoh.
So I want to interrupt for just 1 minute. We've given our listeners a nice overview historically, and we've begun to share with our listeners some of the commonalities of themes. But both Passover and Easter are holidays, observances that are filled with symbols. More than most holidays in the Jewish and Christian world, these have essential, fundamental symbols. Chris, what are the preeminent symbols of Easter, and how do they link to the symbols of Passover?
Yeah, I want to know about the bunny. Tell me about the bunny.
I thought you were going to ask about the chocolate, of all the things.
And we haven't even gotten to the marshmallow peeps. So the silly stuff, of course, are eggs, which are often seen as a symbol of rebirth, of breaking out, life coming out of death. Sometimes celebrating the tomb in the Middle Ages is when they began to color the eggs. We know, of course, under the Russian czars, the giving of the unveiling of the elaborate Fabergé egg. Of course, that would also in the Greek Russian Orthodox Church. The very word Easter is ironically a pagan word, and it may be related to Judaism. In the Anglo-Saxon world, there was a fertility goddess of the spring who kind of opened up the earth so that we could plant, and her name was Easter, E-A-S-T-R-E. We're really not sure how that would have been pronounced, and there's some speculation that that actually is the Hebrew name, the Semitic name, Esther. But the roots of the word in Romance languages, those roots are Hebrew, right? So we could say Happy Passover, but we could also say Blessed Pesach. And that word, Pesach, goes into Latin as Pascua, P-A-S-C-H-A. The Spanish, in Italian, we say Buona Pasqua. In French also. So originally Easter is a later word in the history of Christianity, and the original word for Easter is much is related to Passover, again saying that this is the Passover of Jesus, if you will.
And the word Passover is from Pasah, meaning literally to pass over, because we're told there's the mistake that's saying the Malach HaMovis, the angel of death, passed over. No, it was God himself who passed over. It is God himself who was the director of these plagues. And so this passing over also means a passing into.
So Rabbi Sussman, I just want to clarify the listeners. Rabbi Sussman's referring to that section in Exodus 12 in which the Jews are told to act out the first behaviors of Passover, to slaughter a lamb and to maintain their presence and to go into their abode and place the blood from the sacrifice through hyssop leaves on their doorpost, and God will pass over their houses while the plague impacts on the Egyptians.
I have to add something in that. That's saying, you mean God doesn't know who his people are? So for whom is the blood? It's the statement by these Hebrews, now you are going to free us. Now there's going to be manumission. So it wasn't placing the blood on the lintel so to show God who is a Hebrew. It's to show the Hebrews who they are. And it was a formal acceptance of the return of their deity, their Elohim, to them.
Yes, God doesn't need them, the blood on the lintel, to know who's part of the covenantal people. Mm-hmm. It's for the covenantal people to make a definitive statement as to their affiliation.
And becoming the mezuzah. Being right. Placed on the doorpost of your house. So you know that's a Jewish family inside, because the family inside acknowledges that permanent statement to the outside world that inside is a Jewish home.
When I asked about the symbols, we easily laughed about Easter eggs and chocolate eggs, but both holidays use eggs as essential symbols. What's the egg mean, whether it's the Easter egg or the Russian-Ukrainian painted egg? What's that mean in Christianity? And of course, on the Seder plate, there is an egg as well.
Yeah, and you know, one of the parts of the Anglo-Saxon tradition and you know, mythology is just full of lines that don't make sense, is that there were hares, H-A-R-E, rabbits, right, which procreate and propagate very rapidly new life. And there's a tradition in the Anglo-Saxon world that there are hares who lay eggs, which is not how it happens with the birds
And the bees.
And the bees. But I will leave the Seder plate to Brooks.
Seder plate, it's basically dealing historically, because this is an agricultural time as well. And so there's going to be on that Seder plate the bitter herb reminiscent of the bitterness of the work at brick and mortar. There's going to be charoset or charosis with Ashkenaz. The German Russians will make it from apples, walnuts, and wine. Or Sfardim, the Spanish Portuguese, North African Jews, and Israeli Jews will be placed together in what's known as the Hillel sandwich at one point, so that the bitter and the sweet merge together, so that we are taking all of these in as well. There's a parsley to acknowledge the agricultural aspect of this harvest festival.
The egg is, in both traditions, the notion of resurrection, new life, right?
Rebirth and eternal continuity.
And in the Easter tradition, the single most important image or object is the light. And so sometimes we'll have sunrise services, but there's the darkness, the light that spells the darkness. So traditionally in many Christian churches, they turn out all of the artificial lights. You light a fire, if the weather permits, outside, and then everyone lights a candle from the large fire, the Paschal candle or the Easter candle, which is brought in and dispels the darkness, which replicates Jesus coming to life out of the darkness at the dawn on Easter Sunday. And this is just fabulous, fabulous proclamation called the Exultet, where traditionally a deacon will say, this is the night.
So this, I need to interrupt, because for our listeners, this is the first of a two-part conversation with Rabbi Sussman and with Chris Bellito. You can hear our conversation on CHRI 99.1 FM, or you can download it as a podcast on chri.ca or wherever you download your favorite podcast. We are going to continue our conversation, and it will be broadcast on CHRI next week, or it will be available on podcast. For Jewish Faith and Jewish Facts, I'm Rabbi Stephen Garten, thanking our guests and looking forward to the continuation of our conversation.